at the University of Utrecht. But Yossi is a very well-known figure in the foundations of quantum theory. He's well-known for lots of very careful work, in particular in looking at and clarifying the uncertainty principles in quantum theory, amongst other work. Today, he's going to speak on the analogy between thermodynamics and quantum entanglements.
Well, many thanks.
It's certainly wonderful to be back here at this great institution, and a privilege for me to talk to you. And I will use this traditional pointing stick. My topic is indeed the analogy between thermodynamics and quantum entanglement. And I'm sure you have heard about that before. At least in the last decade or so, there have been numerous papers on this analogy between thermodynamics and entanglement. And before I say anything more, I would perhaps like to warn you that there are several kinds of analogies in the histories of physics, the most famous ones being probably that between Newton's theory of gravitation and Coulomb's theory of electrostatics, which have just the same type of force law. And another type of analogy between electromagnetic waves and light waves discovered by Maxwell, from which Maxwell immediately made the famous conjecture that electromagnetic waves were in fact identical to light waves. And it is this claim of identity which nobody would make about the Coulomb law and Newton's law. In that case, there's just an analogy that is helpful in the way that problems that had already been solved for Newton's gravitational problems could immediately be transposed to problems of electrostatics. So in that case, it's not a claim of identity, for ontological identity between the things studied, but it's merely a common structure in the problems you find in two areas that suggests that you can use ways of solving problems or problems that present themselves in one area and transpose them to another area. And so this will also be my attitude here. I'm not trying to claim that the laws of quantum entanglement are really the same as the laws of thermodynamics, but I'm going to try to tell you and suggest to you that some of the problems that appear in both areas are strikingly analogous, and that techniques that have been used in one area can be transposed to the other area and vice versa in a fruitful manner. Yes. Actually, I've been intrigued by this subject for a long time, but I haven't started to do serious work until about last month during my last visit. And so much of what I'm going to say is really still very in statu nascendi. In fact, it's so premature that I don't have anything original to say. All have been working on various conjectures, which all proved to be wrong. But not to worry, because I found that some of the useful things that I wanted to say had actually been proven by other people. So I'm also here just to tell you about what I found in the literature instead of what I've done myself. Now, here's a sort of overview of the talk. Since I'm talking about an analogy between two subjects, I will have to say something about classical thermodynamics, and I have to say something about quantum entanglement. And then we will start to take a closer look at the analogy, which first turns out to be only partial, but then can be extended. And then there is also a point where the analogy breaks down, but exactly that same point will also be the point where I can start to exploit results in both areas. And then hopefully at the end, I will also have time to draw some conclusions. Oops. So let's get going. I'm talking about classical thermodynamics, the famous theory that has been formulated in the 19th century by various founding fathers. And this is a theory which is concerned with thermal systems. The prototype is a simple gas, but it could also be a more complicated system like the proverbial glass of rum cola, which contains a mixture of various substances, various phases, and so on. And the only condition that I will always consider to be imposed is that the system is in thermal equilibrium. Now, each of such systems is supposed to have a state space, which might be, for example, in the easiest case, the famous pressure volume diagram, but it could be more complicated. And one of the most famous results of classical thermodynamics is the statement of its famous second law, which means that there exists a function called entropy on the state space of any such system. And it has the following property, namely that the entropy of a system can never decrease as a result of an adiabatic process. That is a process which takes some thermal equilibrium state and ends in another thermal equilibrium state. And the classical definition of an adiabatic process is that it obeys the requirement that there is no exchange of heat during that process with the environment of the system. Perhaps as a caveat, I should also warn you that there's another definition of adiabatic, which is very common, especially in quantum mechanics, in which adiabatic process is one that proceeds infinitely slowly, so that the system is always in equilibrium during the process. But that's not the original meaning of the word adiabatic in thermodynamics. That second type of process are called quasi-static in thermodynamics. And in fact, there's a major confusion between the various definitions of adiabatic processes in physics. But this is the classical one, which is applicable to thermodynamics. And again, there are two prototype kinds of processes. Adiabatic processes typically involve doing work on the system. And you can do that by moving a piston. That's the easiest way of doing work on the system. But you could also take some stirring device and rotate that in your system. In that way, you're also capable of doing work, but this time without changing the volume. And both types of these processes are called adiabatic in classical thermodynamics. Now, of course, when that theory was developed in the 19th century, it was only developed with 19th century standards of rigor and precision, which to our modern points of view is fairly weak. So if you look at all these classical texts by Planck and even by Carrière-Théodory, who was a mathematician, you will find that they abound in silent assumptions, unstated premises, and other such unrigorous elements. And so thermodynamics, as it was developed by those authors, is really still a very incomplete theory. And it leaves open many questions to be answered. Amongst them, the question whether the second law of thermodynamics actually holds for all systems we would like to consider. Even Carrea Teodori was only able to prove his, or formulate his second law for what he called simple systems. And it's not an easy manner to say exactly what he meant by a simple system, but you can be assured that that is only the easiest types of systems, and that it's an open question whether the second law of thermodynamics holds for more complicated thermal systems. There's another question that would interest mathematicians, and that is there in fact always a unique entropy for every thermodynamical system? And that's also a question you don't find addressed in those 19th century texts. And so it's essentially still an open question. And of course, there's another problem associated with that. Exactly what type of state transformations can be realized by adiabatic processes? In most cases, these texts, Planck makes abundant use of these processes, but you simply proceed by construction and say, oh, I got this system over here. And then it's obviously always possible to make this transformation in an adiabatic manner and proceed from that to other states. But really, whether all that is obvious is, again, very much open for grabs. Nobody has ever stated exactly what type of processes can be realized in an adiabatic manner. That is to say, until recently. There is a, in my mind, beautiful formulation of thermodynamics in an axiomatic manner given by Leib and Ingvarsson about 10 years ago. And it proceeds by actually starting from the last point. It starts by stating out a number of axioms on adiabatic processes. And so here's more or less a summary of their work. We start out by assuming a relation between thermodynamical equilibrium states with the meaning that there is an adiabatic process that can transform the first state into the second state. And then there are a number of axioms on this relation, plus two other operations on thermodynamical states. One is that you can always compose two systems into a composite system by just considering them to be part of a larger system without actually doing anything to the systems in question. And that is represented here by a simple addition. And also that it is possible to scale up thermodynamical systems. And that's only, it's not made very explicit, but the idea is that, for example, if you have a gas of 1 mole, a certain volume, and a certain energy, and a certain temperature, and a certain pressure, then it's also possible to consider a system consisting of 2 moles with double the volume, double the energy at the same temperature and at the same pressure. So that's the scaled version of a state. Perhaps I should warn you that although this process is, this relation is assumed to hold for states in the same state space, these operations will generally take you out of a single state space. The state space for 2 moles of gas is not the same as the state space for 1 mole of gas. So this state is in a different state space than this one. And obviously, this state will be in the Cartesian product of the state space of these two. Now, up to the axioms. I guess that most of them will seem pretty obvious if you see them. The first two state, well, this is obvious. You can do nothing to a system, and that's an adiabatic process. adiabatic accessibility, as the relation is sometimes called, is transitive if you can go from X to Y via an adiabatic process, and from Y to Z, then you can also go from X to Z adiabatically. If you can do a transformation for one system and for another system, then you can also do the combined transformation for the composite system. And similarly for a scale version. And this axiom actually says that if you introduce a partition somewhere in your system, that is an adiabatic process. And also, if you remove the partition in the system, that's an adiabatic process. This symbol, of course, stands for the relation holding both ways. And finally, this sixth axiom is more or less a continuity requirement. If you can transform this state into that state for an epsilon, which with a very small system that can go to zero, then the claim is that you can also realize that transformation immediately without any help of a third system. However, apart from these six axioms, which seem prima facie rather reasonable, Lieben-Ingvarsson also make use of a seventh statement, which they call the comparability hypothesis, stating that for any two states of the same state space, it's always possible to go from the first to the second or from the second to the first in an adiabatic manner. And it's clear, I hope, to you that that is a very stringent requirement. And also, perhaps, that it's not at all obvious for thermodynamical systems. And so for general thermodynamical systems. And so once again, they claim that this only holds for the so-called simple systems. It's not stated as a law of nature of something which follows immediately from the meaning of the relations in question, but rather something which defines a particular type of system which are simple. And that's why they don't call it an axiom, but only an hypothesis.
Right. If it also obeys seven.
Yes, you can take that as an definition.
And well, let's first go to the next one. The great merit of that additional assumption is that I can prove this very strong theorem, which says the following, that if all these axioms and the comparability hypothesis hold, then there is a function which has the property that it can never decrease once if there is an adiabatic process from the first to the second state. In the same state space, of course, there is. I mean, obviously, as you will find from the second requirement, the entropy of 1 kilogram of gold is going to be half the entropy of 2 kilograms of gold. But that doesn't mean that there is an adiabatic process that can transform one into the other, as the alchemists would like to have. So I'm already referring to the second statement, which says that the entropy is both additive and extensive. Additivity is, of course, relates to the sum. Extensivity relates to the fact that it's homogeneous in the scaling factor. And not only that, but that entropy function is actually unique up to affine transformations, which just means that you are free to choose a scale and a zero point for the entropy function. So that is really a remarkable and general theorem. And I first should say some good things about it. It is, of course, a rigorous theorem, instead, in great contrast to all the derivations that we have from the founding fathers of thermodynamics. And it's also a much, much more general treatment, because we don't need to have any assumptions about differentiability of the state space. We call it, in classical textbooks, entropy is always introduced as a differential on state space, which means that the state space must at least be a differential manifold. But that's not assumed here. And that is a great liberation, because thermodynamical state spaces can show phase transitions where there are singularities, and they can even have variable dimension. It can be, say, two-dimensional in one region and three or four-dimensional in another region of state space. So you could have very weird topology on the state space. And this approach is so general that it allows for all of them. The second point to notice is that actually they use a very much more liberal intended meaning of the word adiabatic. This is a quotation from their work. They say that a state transformation will be considered adiabatic if it's possible to change state X into state Y by means of an interaction with any auxiliary device and the weight in such a way that the device returns to its initial state at the end of the process, where the weight might have changed its position in the gravitational field. Now, that weight is only there to allow for the possibility that the environment does work on the system, or that the system does work on the environment. But the crucial thing to note is that you can use any auxiliary device under the sole condition that that device must be returned to the same state in which you found it when you started to use it. So note that this is much more liberal than the requirement of not interchanging, not exchanging heat with the environment, because the auxiliary device can in fact exchange heat with the environment, as long, of course, as everything returns to the same state in which you started. Well, there are a couple of more notes on the slide. Although I know that many of the physicists, and particularly the people working in statistical physics, were really perhaps annoyed about this work by Lieb and Ingvarsson, and said that this was more or less, well, it was nice to have this sort of cleanup of 19th century thermodynamics, but it was really completely out of step with the modern approaches in statistical mechanics. I actually think that it is an appealing starting point, and for fresh type of attempts to connect classical thermodynamics to statistical physics, because as I hope will transpire in the rest of the talk, it is possible to find a concrete realization of this abstract axiomatic pre-order relation in terms of probability measures on an underlying phase space. Well, that's just what I said on the slide. So that would give room for a new type of approaches in relating statistical physics and thermodynamics.
Heat exchanges with the environment. In the previous trends, sometime back when you talked about Caracciadori, you said that his simple systems, when he was talking about adiabatic changes, there was no heat exchange.
Yes.
So is this then a different notion of simple system? used
here? Yes. That's, I mean, that everything, as I said, there's been no rigorous canonical representation of the theory of classical thermodynamics. And so I'm afraid that I have to say that, yes, the notion of simple system varies from author to author. But the upshot is that the Liepmann-Ingvarsson notion of a simple system is more liberal than Carabellari's notion of a simple system. So in a sense, that's also a problem. However, that's my list of nice things to say about the Liepmann-Ingvarsson approach. But of course, there is this comparability hypothesis, which is quite strong. And as I said, you don't expect anything like that to hold for general systems. And so I would rather drop it if I could. In particularly also because you don't want to rest your case with considering the equilibrium states. Hopefully you would be able to extend thermodynamics also to non-equilibrium states, and then there is no hope that all states will be comparable for a simple system, for a single system. So there is a real interest in asking what would happen to their theorem if you draw the comparability hypothesis.
Excuse me.
Yes.
What's the role of this interpretation of adiabatic in the proof of the theorem? I mean, there is.
Well, of course, the theorem itself relies only on the axioms.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter how you interpret the axioms as long as the interpretation is valid. So in the theorem, it doesn't play any role. But actually, it does play a role in the question whether the axioms are true. It is possible using the old interpretation of adiabatic, then the sixth axiom would fail. But it's just because they have this more liberal definition or interpretation of adiabatic accessibility that the sixth axiom is true. So that's the role of the interpretation. In fact, their own paper is slightly misleading on the subject. That is the heart of the matter. Okay. Having said something about thermodynamics, I'm also going to say something about quantum entanglement. And my first slide should be rather trivial to all of you. We consider a quantum system in a pure state, which is composed of two subsystems. And that pure state can be separable if it's a product state. And then it's also possible to assign states to the components, pure states. But if we have a superposition of product states, then that's what's called an entangled state in quantum mechanics. It's no longer possible to assign pure states to the components. There is also a well-known theorem for entangled pure states. This is the Schmidt bi-orthogonal decomposition theorem, which says that you can always find orthonormal bases on the two component filled spaces such that the total state will look like this. And what's of special interest are the components in front of those states. They make up a factor of positive numbers that sum up to one, which I will call the Schmidt coefficients. And clearly, for a non-entangled state, that factor will look like this. And for a maximally entangled state, like a GHZ state, the coefficients will all be equal. And that's another extreme case. So even by just looking at this theorem, you might get an idea that whether a state is entangled or how much a state is entangled can be sort of read off,
or at least is related to the question what this vector looks like. And in fact, that seems to be true. Well, let me just immediately slip to the next slide. There's a beautiful theorem by Michael Nielsen that says that, well, it's not good. First talk about LOCC operations. But before that, talk about ways of quantifying the amount of entanglement of pure states. There have been many such proposals, many such attempts to introduce a quantitative measure of entanglement. And to be sure, many of those attempts are leading to entropy-like expressions, which already suggest something of connection with thermodynamics. But there have been so many of those attempts that it seems to be a very confusing area. And there have also been attempts to derive a unique measure of the amount of entanglement. But these are also diverging into various directions. And actually, well, I will try to show that it's not a good idea to look for a unique measure of entanglement. So my claim, at least, is that there is no consensus, or if there is a consensus, it's a false consensus. And that really you should concentrate on the following claim, that whatever type of measure you choose to quantify entanglement, there is one property which is crucial and essential. And that is that the amount of entanglement is not allowed to increase under a certain type of operation on quantum states, which are called LOCC operations. In words, that means all the type of state transformations that you can achieve by local processes, local operations on the system, and assisted by classical communications. It's not very easy to give a mathematically precise circumscription of those state transformations. There is one, but it's very unwieldy. So I hope, well, I guess it's familiar to many of the people in the audience. But so I will just speak about those class of transformations in general. Yes?
A local measurement?
A measurement, what I mean, well, okay, so the usual explanation of these operations is there are these two systems. And when one goes to Alice and one goes to Bob. And now Alice is allowed to do anything she likes on her particle. So she can make a measurement on her particle, as long as it doesn't affect anything of Bob's particle. So that's what I mean by local measurement. And she can also make it interact with some third system that she might have and do a measurement on that composite system. She might talk to Bob about the outcomes they find, and Bob might tell her something back about what he found, and so on and so on. Just the only idea is that whatever Alice does does not affect Bob's particle and vice versa. That's the locality idea. Okay. So let's concentrate on those LOCC operations. And there's this beautiful theorem by Michael Nielsen that tells us exactly when these LOCC operations are possible, at least for pure states. And as I tried to allude a little while ago, it's actually completely characterized by the Schmidt coefficients in that Schmidt bioorthogonal decomposition theorem, because the theorem says that you can transform psi into psi prime if and only if there is this relation of majorization between the two vectors. there are many ways to define that relation of microization. Here is a mathematical representation that might not be very intuitive, but what I've always found the most intuitive characterization is as follows. Take any vector that has positive components that add up to 1 and draw a histogram of that distribution, like so. And now imagine that these were not probabilities, but actually incomes or wealth of people in society. And now imagine that you are Robin Hood and you want to equalize wealth over the society. So what you do is you take away something from the rich and then distribute that to the poor. Under the sole condition that in this redistribution of wealth, you should not make the poor richer than the rich were before you started to redistribute. Because then, after you give away something to the poor, then you have to take something back from the poor to restore.
What defines the rich and what defines the poor?
Oh, just the height of this column.
So are the two richest people the rich and everyone else the poor, or are the three richest people rich?
There's just an ordering in richness, but any transformation that let me be slightly more clear. If Q is a distribution that results from such a transfer of wealth, then P happens to be majorizing Q.
But why aren't they all equal? I mean, there must be something. Why not just say
that's the extreme case? I mean, so if Robin Hood continues doing that, in the end, he will have realized the distribution like that, and then there is nothing more to distribute.
Right.
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 So that's the extreme case. That's maximal uniformity. And this,
but what I don't understand is the definition is, does that definition mean to just do it once? Or
the definition
obstructs the extreme, what obstructs you from getting the extreme case?
Nothing. But you can imagine that even Robin Hood has only limited means of robbing people. So he can take a small amount and distribute it to some. And then at least he would have created a more equal distribution. So any distribution, any transfer that does that defines a relation of microization, an instance of the relation of microization. But of course, if this is, say, the uniform distribution, and this one, call it delta, is the extreme concentration in which all the wealth is in one hand, then you certainly will have this relation for any other probability distribution. But this relation will also hold just in case there is a partial redistribution of wealth that increases uniformity. Is that clear?
In the context of LACC operations, the allowable operations are those of the Sheriff of Nottingham rather than Robin Hood, right?
Yes. That's because there's this. This is just talking about an abstract probability distribution. But in this case, y'all, you should know there's this inversion, that G prime is measured by G psi instead of the other way around.
should it be the opposite? Because if psi prime is more entangled, then p psi prime is more disordered. And I can go from entangled state to a more entangled state to a less entangled.
Yes.
Did I write it?
Yes, you're right. I
think so. Primes are backwards on the
yes, side. Yes. I'm sorry about that.
That's like a moment.
But I hope to clear what I mean. Okay, so in a sense, microization means that this distribution is more uniform than that. At least that's the idea. And the minimal requirement of this entanglement measure is that it should respect that order. And I hope now that this is right. So this is the more uniform distribution. Which means that it's the more entangled one with which you can reach less entangled states. Yes. Okay. Now I hope it's clear that there is already some partial analogy between the two areas. In thermodynamics, there is this relation of adiabatic transformations. And in entanglement theory, there's this class of LOCC operations. And in both cases, we're looking at measures that can only change one way, either increase or decrease, under that type of process. So let's try and see if these axioms are really valid in the case of quantum entanglement. And you will immediately see by the definition of microization that this is also a free order. Just like that means just like the first two axioms of Leibniz. And if you interpret combinations as taking tensor products in quantum states, or equivalently, just taking ordinary products of probability factors, then action 3, as formulated by Leibniz, also holds for quantum entanglement. And similarly, for taking multiple copies, and action 5 poses no problem, action 6 poses no problem. It's just two things that fail about the system. It's possible to have a situation that Q does not matcherize probability distribution P, but that if you take the products of the two, then you find that the matcherization relation holds. And perhaps even more striking, there's a lemma that's not part of the axioms, but which actually immediately follows from the axioms, which Leibniz called cancellation, which says that if you can transform X into Y with the help of a service system Z that doesn't change its state, then you can also go from X to Y, which is, of course, a natural thing to expect given their interpretation that you might use any auxiliary device as long as it doesn't change its state. However, that very statement fails when you translate it to quantum entangled states. That was famously discovered by Jonathan and Plenio. So in the case of quantum theory, that means that it might be a case that there are two states that you cannot transform into each other by local operations, classical communications. But there's a third quantum system, such that if you add that to the total, then you can transform this tensor product into this tensor product. And that's what they called catalysis, for obvious reasons. And that was a very surprising discovery in 1999. And the way to proceed was also suggested by Nielsen. You could, of course, try to extend the pre-order, the modularization relation, in the following way: introduce a new pre-order called trumping, which is defined by it holds just in case that there is a third system or a third distribution, such that modularization holds for these pairs of probability distributions. And if that happens, then you say that P is termed by Q. And this is an extension of modularization, so it means that if modularization holds, then something holds too. But the converse implication fails. Now, it happens to be the case that once you replace modularization by trumping, that both of the points on which the analogy failed on the previous slide are fixed. So now I've got a complete validity of all the axioms that Lieben and Poisson imposed. Which is nice. However, there's no way you can derive comparability hypothesis except when you're dealing with qubits, because it's simply not the case that probability distributions over more than two elements are completely ordered by either by the modularization relation or by the trumping relation for that matter. So comparability just fails. And that might, you might become pessimistic after learning that and say, oh, the analogy doesn't work out. But remember that I already said that I would like to get rid of that hypothesis. So having a failure of that hypothesis here is actually, in a sense, good news. But the real question, of course, is, can you still obtain something which is analogous to that beautiful theorem that Lieben and Poisson obtained? And here's where I've been trying to work on the subject, but I fortunately found that that theorem had already been proved just a while ago, independently apparently, by Turgut and Klinisch. And they showed that there is a representation for trumping in the following way. There's two technical, well, it's only one technical requirement here, but the probability distributions have only non-zero elements. And then the trumping relation holds if and only if there's a whole bunch of inequalities for a certain type of expression, which is well known from the famous book by Hardy, Littlewood, and Polya, who studied this function quite extensively. And if you have no familiarity with that expression, given any probability distribution, this expression will give you a function that looks like this, and its maximum is given by, well, also the maximum of all the probabilities. And the value here at minus infinity is given by the minimum of all the probabilities. There's value right here where r is minus 1, where it's just 1 over the support of all the probabilities, where the support is the size of the set of non-zero elements. And for r is 0, it's equal to the exponent of minus Shannon entropy.
And so long for r is 1, it's of course equal to sum of t squared. And it's a continuous monotonic function. And so this theorem says that the trunking relation holds just in case this number comes. Just in case, if I have a second distribution, it should be above over here and smaller over here. So this is P, this is Q. And that's exactly the case where something relation. They must, of course, be equal over here, because if they don't have non-zero elements, then this will be the number of elements in the probability distribution for both distributions, so they intersect over here. As I said, these expressions are well known, and it's sometimes more convenient to take a logarithm or minus the logarithm, because they're all smaller than 1. And then they're known as Renyi entropies, at least for values larger than minus 1. But surprisingly, for this theorem, you also need the expressions for more negative values of r, in which case they're not well known as, they're not Renyi entropies, but they are still interesting. But regardless of the exact form of that theorem, what is important is that we do have this representation theorem, not in terms of a unique entropic measure, but in terms of a family of entropic-like expressions. And all of these expressions are additive and extensive in the sense that if you take a look with them, then you will have this relation. So we have an infinite collection of additive and extensive entropic-like expressions that simultaneously collectively characterize some big relation, which, as we have seen, obeys all the axioms of the Lyapunov. So what I now would like to do is to see where this leaves us, or where it leads us, if we want to go further. So this is something that came up in entanglement theory, and now we can take those insights and go back to thermodynamics and ask the obvious question. What would happen if we simply drop the comparability hypothesis, maintain the other axioms, and what will happen then to the second law of Leibniz-Pascal? Can we still state the same conclusion, but now for a family of entropy expressions? And the answer turned out to be yes. And again, I found the result in another paper, surprisingly perhaps, in economics. This is about decision theory, because there is a third type of analogy where people in decision theory talk about preferences of rational agents. And a sort of minimal requirement on that preference relation is that it forms a preorder. The classical results in decision theory presuppose that it is a complete order, where that seems to be quite an idealistic assumption about rational agents. And what people want to do in those cases is also to construct a function, which they call the utility, such that it will represent the preference relations of rational agents. And so here's the theorem that is known in decision theory. Suppose that you have a preorder on
space, which is supposed to be a mixture space, meaning that if you have two elements of that space, then there is this addition defined on state space, such that if you take a convex mixture of the two states, then that will also be an element of your state space. And I hope you'll see, or you remember from the axioms that I showed earlier, that this is true for the Lieben-Ingrassen approach. There is also this condition, which, as you might see, is also true in the Lieben-Ingrassen case, because if this holds, then by cancellation, you can drop out these extra terms. And then by the scaling property, Tx is Ty is accessible from Tx if and only if x is accessible, if y is accessible from x. The next property is really just a reformulation of the continuity assumption. It says that if this the class of all factors T for which this relation holds must be a closed subset of the interval 0, 1, which means that if you have a sequence of T's converging to some other T prime, then the relation will hold for T prime if it holds for that sequence of T's. And then the theorem says that this relation holds if and only if there is a whole family, closed convex family of functions that are both additive and extensive, such that this relation holds. And the crucial part, of course, is this if and only if part. I mean, it's not difficult to find one function that respects that deep order, but crucial result is that if they're valid for all of these functions, then you can also go backwards and conclude that a pre-order works.
So, in a sense, this solves an important problem in thermodynamics. You can drop the comparability hypothesis, and then the second law doesn't fall apart. The result is only that you have a non-unique entropy expression. So you have a whole collection of entropy expressions. And only if there is an increase of entropy or a non-decrease of entropy for all of them, then there is an adiabatic process between the two states. But of course, you might also want to look at things the other way. Given that we have these results in thermodynamics, can we exploit them in quantum entanglement? And the answer, I think, is again yes, because you might remember that Nielsen's theorem and the bioorthogonal decomposition theorem only apply to pure states. And clearly, we also want to say something about the entanglement of mixed states, and this is still a very much more complicated issue. Especially if you look at this problem, how do we quantify entanglement of mixed states? So in this case, since Nielsen's theorem fails, we cannot rely on that simple property of majorization of the Schmidt coefficients. We'll have to look at something much more complicated, which is actually unknown, as far as I am aware. But now, of course, remember that the thermodynamical approach was completely axiomatic. So we didn't need to know what the concrete realization of these relations were. So forget about majorization or trumping, and simply talk about this relation between mixed states as, well, LOCC accessibility, but now also possibly assisted by entanglement catalysis. And recall that that's very much in the spirit of Lieben-Ingrassen, because what you do if you allow a catalysis is just allow an additional auxiliary device that happens to be returned into the same state at the end of the process that it had at the beginning of the process. The only thing is now that that system is allowed to be entangled. So then you can apply that result that I just showed on the previous slide and conclude that also for mixed states, there must be a closed convex collection of entropy-like expressions that will be additive and extensive that will collectively represent that ELOC accessibility relation. Which I think is not known yet in the literature. Now, of course, the next question to decide would then be, what is that class of functions? And unfortunately, I don't have any idea yet. It seems to be much more complicated than in the pure state case, because it's known that Nielsen and Kemp found an example of two quantum states that have exactly the same spectrum, both globally and for the reduced states. And yet one state is entangled and the other state is not entangled, which by itself implies that there will be no simple functional of mixed quantum state that could by itself do the job of these functions. So we will have to look for something much more complicated. But
eigenvalues and eigenvectors.
But
sure.
But what I mean is,
eigenvalues and the eigenvectors.
I mean, what I mean is,
that's right. Never mind.
Of course, the natural thing to ask is, great, if I take something like analogous expression that we had in the pure state case. Yeah. That's not going to help, because that only depends on the eigenvalues in the spectral decomposition of that state. So, this machine refuses to draw conclusions. No. Well, I guess in that case, I'll just do it by heart. Well, coming back to this notion of analogy, I think there is this nice analogy between thermodynamics and entanglement theory, and in fact, also with the problems of position theory, which should not be seen necessarily as an identity of all the subjects involved. I think nobody will even be tempted to conclude that preferences and utilities are the same things as LOCC operations and measures of entanglement. But still, the techniques that have been already applied in one field can fruitfully be employed in other fields. To our great benefit. There was another conclusion about thermodynamics. There's a quote from Leib and Ingvarsson in which they said that, well, they themselves actually don't like that comparability hypothesis. But they found it crucial in their derivation of their theorem. And they said that this comparability hypothesis is crucial for the existence of entropy. And I think that these results show that that's slightly mistaken. It's not crucial for the existence of entropy. It's only crucial for the uniqueness of an entropy function. But you can still have a meaningful version of the second law without the comparability hypothesis. Is there another conclusion? No, well, I guess I'd better just stop here. Yeah.
Yeah, so how do you deal with, I mean, so this theorem that you cited, consistence theory, again uses fractional t between 0 and 1?
Yes.
So how do you deal with that in the entanglement case?
Well, I'm just adopting this interpretation in which I think I have not been explicit about it. But the idea is first that you this is equivalent to right.
What do you mean by equivalent?
What?
Equivalent in what sense?
That you
that the trumping relation is the same for both.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. That the trumping relation. Yeah, the trumping relation holds this way. And it also holds this way.
No. Is that what you mean? Or you mean that? You mean you're normally trumping is between things of this. I mean, you can't change the dimension, right?
No, I'm not changing dimensions.
You mean that P tensor Q
let this be an arbitrary. Sorry, I'm confusing.
He's padding it out so the thing.
Yeah, okay, that's okay. Yes, okay, good. Okay.
Which means I can sort of identify these two cases. And so when I'm writing this, I'm interpreting this as being the same statement as at least for rational values of t. And then by these continuity assumptions, I can extend that to real fractional values of t.
Okay. Okay, so now I'm a little confused about a different point, which is that I thought in the asymptotic case, there was a unique entropy, which is the von Neumann entropy.
For trumping?
Well, I didn't think in the asymptotic case, I wasn't sure you even needed to have entanglement analysis. But maybe it's a slightly different measure, because you only have to get with asymptotically high fidelity. And maybe that's why.
Yeah. Well, there's certainly some points that maybe should have. I'm only considering cases where of entanglement transformations which can happen with certainty. I now recall one of my other conclusions as well. The striking aspect of both Lieben-Ingvarsson's work and the way I've been approaching entanglement is that you only use the properties or actions on this accessibility relation. Nowhere do I impose any requirements on the measure in question. And what most of the attempts that lead to a unique measure of entanglement have in common is that they do impose requirements on such a measure. For example, that's the simple requirement that the measure of entanglement for unentangled systems must be zero, which is harmless, but it's only conventional requirement. If you make any requirements on the numerical value of such measures.
If you have a separable state, that's equivalent under LACC to attempt product state, for instance. So that's kind of the minimum class, right?
Yes.
In your inequality always. So you might as well set that to be zero.
Yeah, but that's just the convention.
Sure.
The nice thing about this approach is that you don't use the convention. You only look at the LACC class operations and derive the entropy measures from that. So the crucial thing is that you find a set of expressions that represent that class of transformations unique. The numerical values of the entanglement measures is actually not so very important. And any attempt to characterize these transformations by a single measure means a loss of information because this relation is not completely ordered. So you cannot conclude from a comparison of the measures of entanglement whether they're transformable to each other by LACC.
One question. I think what Daniel was referring to is the possibility of considering an asymptotic scenario where you have many copies, and then you consider rates of transformations from one state to another, but when you're considering many copies of both states, and then it was proven that there is, in this sense, a unique measure that is just the entropy of entanglement. Mm-hmm. So when you consider your Schmidt coefficients, and you consider the, say in this case, the Shannon entropy of the Schmidt coefficients. And this provides you a rate of
I guess in that context, you do have the comparability hypothesis factor.
Well,
you can always convert, some either psi to some number of phi or phi to some number of psi.
Yeah, I mean,
it was a constant.
But this was okay. Coming for me, and because again, it is asymptotic scenario. People, there is recent work by Martin Daniel and Fernando Bernal, where they still, they define a new class of operations that is, I think, asymptotically non-entanglement creating something. So LOCC do not create entanglement. They consider a larger risk, and they consider many copies. And, well, I'm not able tell you age or whatever, but they prove that there is a corresponding measure that provides the rate of transformation under such class of operations that is the so-called regularization of relative entropy of entanglement.
Uh-huh.
So there are measures that, and they actually refer to these adiabatic transformations, and so they think that their class of transformations correspond to adiabatic transformations in the entanglement complex. So maybe.
Okay, I will look at that work because I don't know. But I think that these theorems, this is an if and only if state. And so, of course, the Shannon entropy is amongst these expressions. But it's an if and only if state, and so you have to have inequality in all these expressions before you can say that there's something, and therefore, for the something between these two.
No, I think that philosophy is quite
different. So there's not, if the general entropy increases, but the other expressions do not, then it cannot possibly be the case that there's something.
I think it's a difference in the measure. In the normal asymptotic case, you only consider creating it with high fidelity, asymptotic high fidelity. So that's different.
That's probably the difference.
Maybe we should stop here and thank Yoss.